ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hi, Sarah Kanoski here. I recently sat down for a conversation with the former Prime Minister of New Zealand, Jacinda Ardern. We talked about her upbringing as a good Mormon girl, her unusual path into political leadership, and how she navigated some of the most terrible events in the history of New Zealand.
I felt such rage that part of the way they designed this horrific attack was to try and get people to react violently.
Hear my conversation with Jacinda Ardern now by searching for Conversations on the ABC Listen app.
It's been over 3 years since war broke out between Sudan's army and the paramilitary Rapid Support Forces.
Since then, over 13 million people have been displaced.
It's the world's biggest humanitarian crisis.
And with international aid groups pushed to their limit, something needs to change. I'm Latika Burke.
And I'm Kylie Morris. On this episode of Global Roaming, we're returning to Sudan.
Kylie, we discussed Sudan in February, and since then, a very grim milestone has been passed, which is why we thought it was time to return to this topic today here on Global Roaming.
That's right. We're now, well, it's 3 years since the war broke out, which means we're entering the fourth year of conflict there, and a massive humanitarian crisis persists there and worsens. Last time we talked about Sudan, we were talking about really the origins of the conflict and which groups were fighting whom and why, and all of those realities are still in place. But certainly what we're hearing from Sudan itself is that the risks are getting ever higher, if that was possible. We've seen genocidal violence against civilians in El Fasher, with tens of thousands of people displaced from there. Now there are warnings that that kind of an onslaught might be about to take place in another province. And we're hearing that drones are now in the skies taking aim at civilians as they seek shelter.
Yes, Kylie, the drones was something you and I discussed on that last episode, and we should recommend that, by the way, if listeners want to get a good primer before even they listen to this episode. These two will sit very well together. But I'm very interested to find out exactly how warfare in Sudan is taking shape, because it seems to me that this is something. It's happening in conflicts right around the world. Obviously, the two big ones that everyone's been watching is Iran and Ukraine. But what is materializing in Sudan, and how is that affecting responses to the humanitarian catastrophe that war creates? But also, what are the lessons that we should be learning from this conflict that goes so unobserved in the international community?
They are important questions. I mean, last time around, Latika, we spoke to Matt Nasher. Do you remember? He's a freelance journalist who covers Sudan.
Yes.
And that episode, in fact, was called Who Profits from Sudan's Endless Civil War? So it was more focused on who was drawing out the conflict and why the roles that were being played by other countries outside of Sudan, like Saudi Arabia and the UAE, and the way that they're using proxy fighters inside Sudan itself. Today, though, we're speaking to Noah Taylor.
Yes, Kylie, originally from Melbourne. Noah Taylor has extensive experience in humanitarian and emergency response. He's worked for the Victorian government, the ADF, the Defence Force. Now he heads operations for the Norwegian Refugee Council's Sudan program. So he is perfectly poised to give us a first-hand account of the conditions that he and his teams face on the ground in Sudan.
Noah Taylor, welcome to Global Roaming.
Thank you so much for having me.
So, Noah, I don't want to talk specifically about where you are at the moment, but I know that you've done quite a bit of work in the last few days and weeks in West Darfur, also in El Awaid. Tell me what you're seeing on the ground in the refugee camps. Where is the most critical area of need?
Sudan right now has just crossed a horrific threshold, and that's 3 years of war. That's 3 years of displacement. That's 3 years of destroyed families, of people constantly being on the move, constantly feeling unsafe, and moving not just in Sudan, but outside through Chad, through South Sudan, and through some of the poorest countries in the region. I've just traveled back into West Darfur through Chad. And even on that side of the border, seeing the state of families living in camps that are drastically under-supported, heaving at the seams with too many people and not enough services. And this has been going on for 3 years now. We are not seeing the level of assistance that we need. People are not able to access basic services, including food, water, and healthcare. And the services that are provided are underfunded, drastically under-supported, and constantly at risk of being shut down. We have not nearly enough support to get these people what they need, and it doesn't look like it's getting any better anytime soon.
Can I ask, once someone finds their way into a camp, are they broadly safe?
Safety is incredibly relative in Sudan. A lot of the families that I've met in displacement camps across this country have not moved once. They've moved 3, 4, 5, or 6 times in the last 6 months alone. A lot of the displacement sites that my organization and other humanitarian organizations work in provide some level of safety and some level of an ability to access services reliably. But these are not safe in the way that we might think of safety back home in Australia. A lot of these camps are still subject to attacks. I visited a displacement site in Al Obeid about a month ago in North Kordofan. This camp was subsequently struck by a drone a couple of weeks after I was there. So this shows you that the level of indiscriminate violence towards civilians isn't reserved for people outside of displacement sites. There is nowhere that is safe in Sudan, and this is particularly dangerous for women and for children who are really bearing the brunt of this war.
What's the purpose of using drones? Are these militias trying to corral people into specific areas? Are they seeking control of those areas and they want people to move away? Do you understand what the strategy is?
I couldn't speculate on the military strategy for the use of drones, but what we've seen in the last 6 months particularly is a significant increase in the number of drone strikes and the indiscriminate nature of what these drones are actually targeting. We've seen a real shift away from some of the type of warfare that we saw last year that was much more focused on large-scale assaults and more into this indiscriminate bombardment, which we're now seeing around key centres like Al Obeid. What's particularly worrying about the increased use of drones is that the targeting is not limited to military targets. In Al Obeid alone, last month we had nearly 45 civilians killed by drones. Fuel stations are being struck, schools are being struck, hospitals are being struck, and key resources moving along the road into this city, including aid convoys, have also been struck. So now the ability of these militias and armed groups to reach targets far beyond their areas of control is incredibly worrying and puts everybody in Sudan at extreme risk. We have an education program and children are describing the sounds different weapon systems make as a form of their play. So this is now being reflected in the next generation and in children's daily lived experience of Sudan.
Noah, we have a better sense now of the terrible level of genocidal violence that was used by militias like the RSF in the city of El Fasher in North Darfur last year, which has led to so many of the refugees finding their way to the camps that you've been describing. But now there are alarms being raised, certainly by the UN and by your organisation, that similar violence could come to El Abayid, so in North Kordofan. Tell me about that place and why it is that people are now nervous that a similar kind of military assault might be about to happen there.
Al Obeid is increasingly encircled by the RSF. We've had a deliberate movement of troops around the city in an effort to choke off access of aid organizations and aid support into the city, but also civilians to effectively leave the city. We don't want to speculate on imminent military outcomes, but there is a palpable sense of fear in the city. And I felt this when I was there a month ago, that an attack is imminent. We have seen this play multiple times before in Sudan. It is a very, very similar flow of events to what we saw in Al Fasher. So there is increased anxiety that we are looking at a similar instance, and the indiscriminate use of these drones and aerial bombardments and a choking off of the city from key supplies is exactly the same type of activity we have seen in multiple locations. the people who can't leave this city are the ones most vulnerable. And this is what we're incredibly worried about right now, and calling for immediate protection of civilians and guaranteed access to these cities so that we can get people the assistance that they need and that people who want to leave can leave and can do so safely.
Noah, who could provide, though, immediate protection to the civilians?
The international community has been largely missing in this war. And despite Sudan feeling sometimes far away from diplomatic reach, there is plenty more that the international community could do to guarantee the protection of civilians. We need immediate action, whether that's through UN Council resolutions or key diplomatic pressure on the warring parties and their backers, to guarantee the protection of civilians, to make sure that al-Fasha never happens again and that the mass atrocities we saw reported there are not repeated. There is an opportunity here, and there long has been an opportunity for direct diplomatic pressure and engagement, and we have continued to see the international community lacking. And this is not as a result of an inability or an incapacity for international actors to properly engage in this. It is a lack of political will. We have seen this time and time again, and at 3 years of war, the people of Sudan are exhausted and they deserve better. Those who can't leave, as we saw in al-Fasha and as we are now seeing again in El-Obeid and in Kadugli, those are the ones we are incredibly worried about. Those are the people who have elderly, sick, small children who simply cannot pick up and leave every time there is a bombardment, every time there is a risk of an advance, and every time there is the risk of an atrocity. These are the people who get caught in the crossfire, and these are the people who pay the price.
Noah, you mentioned children there, and I guess, as you know, given that there is now 3 years of displacement, as you're so calmly and professionally articulating at the moment, what happens to these children in terms of not only their safety and their food and their medical needs, but also the prospect of schooling and education? I mean, you talked about children describing the different kinds of sounds of a military assault, but what support is actually being delivered or able to be delivered in a camp to the children with a situation so changeable and so consistently dangerous?
So children are bearing the brunt of this war across the country. Amongst displaced children, only about 45% of children in a displacement setting have regular access to education provided by either us or another organisation. That is a fraction, and nearly one in five families have access to absolutely no education at all. Where they do have access to that education, it is continually disrupted. Schools that I visited are massively overcrowded with incredibly high student-to-teacher ratios, which just means there simply isn't enough time to address the needs of every child. And these needs are increasingly psychosocial. The trauma that we're seeing manifest in children across the country, but specifically in places like al-Fasha and like El-Obeid, is incredibly worrying. Children acting out warfare as playtime, using the names of the leaders of some of these warring parties in their games, drawing weapons that they know are used, mimicking the sounds of a drone strike. Combined with all of this, we're also seeing a lot of children who are now just outside of school completely being forced into labour. 18% of households are being compelled to send children into work. Family separation triples the risk of child marriage in Chad specifically, and it nearly doubles child labour. So you have a fraction of children who can access education, the majority of whom are not able to access the proper services that they need, and those who can't access education are being forced into work and forced to grow up far earlier than anybody should be. These are children who are missing their childhood and are missing the chance simply to be children.
What are the dreams and desires of the Sudanese in this context? And how do organisations like yourself, but also how does the international community go about trying to deliver that?
Look, the people in Sudan want peace. The people need this war to be over. Despite there being a collapse in funding in the last 12 months particularly, and an apparent lack of political will globally to really settle this crisis, the solidarity and the bonds between community remain as strong as ever. Where people can access aid and assistance, either in Sudan or in neighbouring countries as refugees, people are sharing all of the assistance that they can. People are making sure that everybody in their community gets some form of assistance. The diaspora network is very active, alive and across the world, as people are sending money into the country, into their families, to try to support them, to try to make some ends meet. All of our staff across Sudan continually send money to families either displaced outside of the country or in other parts of the country. So the bonds are still there. People want peace. People want a future. People want the ability to pick for themselves what this looks like, and people want a break from this relentless warfare. The international community must stand in solidarity with the people of Sudan, and they have continually failed time and time again. The political commitments have been hollow, have been meaningless, and have not guaranteed the protection for civilians that is so desperately needed. We're not calling for any immediate political action other than what the people of Sudan are asking for themselves.
I'm Kylie Morris here with Latika Burke on Global Roaming, and you're hearing from Noah Taylor, who's the head of operations in Sudan for the Norwegian Refugee Council, about the fourth year of Sudan's civil war and the terrible impacts it's having on civilians there. Noah, what about the neighbouring countries? Many of them are providing shelter, of course, to these refugees. I'm thinking particularly of Chad. How important has the role been of similarly poor African countries who are coming to the aid of those seeking, you know, safe passage, seeking a new home from Sudan?
So approximately 4 million people have fled to neighbouring countries since April 2023. That's from the United Nations High Commission for Refugees. These countries are desperately poor themselves, and yet their people and their governments have expressed a lot of solidarity and generosity in hosting and continuing to host refugee populations and providing them with some means of being able to generate an income and live their lives in relative peace. Like you pointed out, though, these countries are grappling with their own problems. Chad and South Sudan are not stable, peaceful countries that do not have the means to support these huge refugee populations. And over the last 12 months, particularly, we have seen significant decrease in funding for the refugee response and an ability for these people to actually be able to make choices about either returning, building a life in this country, or then seeking a third country resettlement option. These options are simply not available. Traveling through Eastern Chad on the way into West Darfur, you can see the impact of these cuts. Shelters are in desperate state of needing to be repaired. There is simply not enough water. Food supplies are getting cut off. We've also just entered into the wet season in Sudan and Eastern Chad, which makes access particularly difficult for getting large quantities of food and medical supplies into some of these really, really remote camps. This makes the risk of diseases like cholera incredibly prevalent and really hampers the ability to access aid across the board. These countries have done an amazing job so far, and we need to ensure that we continue to support them.
Your teams must face very high risks as they try to move around the different provinces to deliver aid and meet the people where they are. How are you managing to keep operations going?
Moving through Sudan is one of the most challenging things I've done in my entire career. Our teams do this daily. We have a number of safety measures in place to make sure that we can follow up with them, make sure that they are safe. And we do what we need to do in terms of engaging with various warring parties to make sure that that access is well planned and advanced, is known and is secure. But make no mistake, this is incredibly dangerous. We have seen continued attacks on aid workers, harassment at checkpoints, blockages for being able to access people in need, and in the worst circumstances, drone strikes that have actually hit aid convoys. My team are incredibly brave. They put their lives on the line daily to reach people in need, as do all staff for humanitarian organizations in Sudan, as well as, critically, the local responders who do not have the cover of being staff of a large international NGO, but are volunteers, are community organizations who help their people and continually are harassed, are continually blocked, and are continually sometimes detained and have their funds and their relief items stolen. This has to end.
Now, what can Australians do? I mean, there'd be a lot of people sitting at home listening to this or driving and thinking, gosh, this is terrible. But it's not as though, you know, they're a long way away. Many of us now have Sudanese communities in our towns and cities. And of course, for those people, it would feel very close. But it's easy for some people to put this to one side. There's so many terrible things going on in the world, you know, from Ukraine to the Middle East to Sudan. What would your advice be to someone who thinks there isn't a way to involve themselves or that this isn't something that is relevant to them?
Australia itself has options. We might not be the largest country as a donor base to provide the funds or the leverage needed to end this war, but we are nothing of a small political diplomatic voice. We can reach out when we need to. And as a non-permanent member of the Security Council, this includes engagement with the UN at the highest levels. There's diplomatic avenues for Australia to increase its pressure on the warring parties and their backers to come to a peaceful solution to this conflict and to protect civilians. But at the local level, what I would say to Australians who are listening to this and feel hopeless is reach out to your Sudanese communities, reach out to the diaspora network, talk to these people, understand where their families are from, understand how you can help. There are many avenues through a number of organizations in Australia if you would like to donate, but listen to these people, hear their stories, understand where they're from in Sudan, understand what their families are going through, understand what their journey was like to come to Australia and build that solidarity, reinforce that community strength that we are seeing play out in Sudan, support these people in Australia, and that will go a long way.
No, I can hear the absolute frustration in your voice. Why do you think it is that the global community has largely turned away from Sudan?
I don't know. And this is something that we grapple with regularly. The scale of this suffering is immense. This is the world's largest displacement crisis. And this anniversary that we've just passed is an opportunity to correct that if we want to. There are a range of humanitarian catastrophes, crises, and wars that are drawing the world's attention, but Sudan is continually falling off the radar, is continually missing the opportunity to be thrust into the spotlight and have people talk about this catastrophe. I don't know why. I don't know why it doesn't get the attention it so deserves, but 3 years in, when are we going to cross a milestone where it does finally get the attention that it needs? When are we going to finally do something to actually move the needle on this crisis meaningfully? Because up until now, we have seen absolutely nothing. We crossed these milestones, we had limited engagement, a few headlines, and then it fades from consciousness. And my concern is that I will be having this conversation in 12 months' time when we cross year four and nothing will be any different.
Noah, thank you so much for speaking to us.
Thanks so much.
That was Noah Taylor, who's the head of operations in Sudan for the Norwegian Refugee Council, speaking there from West Darfur. Oh, Latika, it's hard not to feel overwhelmed, but that's kind of his point, isn't it? That actually no one has the luxury of that when it comes to this place and the mass displacement and the harm that is being done daily to so many people that you can't turn away, and that we all have a responsibility to engage.
I mean, I found that so horrifically bleak, Kylie, when he was describing how children are learning to play the sounds of warfare. It's an innocence they never get back, that rupture.
Mm. I've spoken to Noah a couple of times over the years, and I'm always struck by his determination and his passion and also his sense of kind of justice, right? His sense that no one deserves this, that it's not okay for this to be happening. And I think anyone, as he has, who's been through or witnessed the people who escaped from Al-Fashir and fully understand the terrible levels of genocidal violence that was enacted there by the RSF, the prospect that that could be about to happen again somewhere else, and no one is coming to the rescue, you know, there is no peace deal being worked out.
Mm.
It must just be devastating, I think. I guess on the flip side, it's not exactly a flip side, but on a more positive note, the fact that you have neighbours within the region who have, despite their own kind of lacking systems, opened their borders to refugees from inside Sudan, and nations like Chad, who have their own problems, who are hosting and continue to welcome refugees from Sudan. It does tell you something about, even if international institutions are failing, there is a kind of regional solidarity which is helping.
Mm. You know, Kylie, you and I have spoken before about this in relation to Sudan on previous episodes of Global Roaming, but I also thought this shift that he described in the last 12 months and the use of drones to attack civilians, civilian infrastructure indiscriminately. Mm. I think that's a very, very disturbing trend that even if the international community does not have the bandwidth to absorb and deal with the catastrophic humanitarian situation, which of course they should, that goes without saying. But even if in that scenario they couldn't, then I do think the change in warfare that he described, its effects on the civilian population, the added strain it then places on organisations like his, is something that we should all be watching very carefully, because this is what is happening in conflicts right around the globe, this use of low cost but very devastating equipment, specifically drones, to create havoc. And we don't have any good answers. We don't have good answers at the Ukraine level or NATO level about how to stop drones coming into airspace. We certainly don't see in Sudan good answers for how to stop drones attacking civilian infrastructure. These are solutions that the international community really does need to be worried about and trying to solve before this contagion spreads out of control to their own districts and their own communities, because it's very, very easy for nefarious actors, and it doesn't have to be militias. It doesn't have to be state actors. It could be drug cartels. It could be bikie gangs. It could be criminal groups authorized by non-state actors in foreign countries. Anybody could get their hands on this technology and create enormous damage and death. And it, to me, if there's any self-interested reason to be taking notice of what is taking place in Sudan, what Noah described there was it.
Yeah, and I think when we talk about drones, often, you know, we talk about, you know, the state actors in this, in, you know, the Iranian manufactured drones, the Chinese manufactured drones, you know, the Russians using them. But we don't always focus on what it's like to be a member of a civilian community. We've seen some of those testimonies from inside Gaza, certainly. But yes, the idea that this is another terrifying reality that people in Sudan have to face is almost too much to bear.
I mean, can you just imagine it, Kylie? Going to school and a drone coming down on top of you. Mm. It's just, it's unfathomable, yet it's so realistic because it's so possible. Mm.
I did like his reminder, his advice to speak to the Sudanese people within your own communities. You know, if you live in a town of any size pretty much in Australia, there's every likelihood that there'll be a Sudanese refugee family or community who you live amongst you and live with you and maybe live on your street. And his advice is, well, engage with those people, you know, find out where they came from, find out what's going on for their families, because of course so many of them will still have people inside Sudan.
And his lovely point that the diaspora is still very much, you know, supporting, I thought that was a nice positive note too. Okay, Kylie, well, we love feedback. Please send it all in. We do read it all. So it's global.roaming@abc.net.au. That is where you find us. You can, of course, give us your thoughts on this episode and suggest what you like for future episodes.
Those prompts do really help. They get through. It's a busy world and there's lots to focus on, but certainly if there's something that you want to hear more of and that you want to better understand, we would really like to know that. Thanks as always to our producers, Aston Brown, supervising producer Pat Sunderland and executive producer Laura McAuliffe. See you, Latika.
Kylie, see you next time.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.